This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special POW MIA Day edition of the program, bringing you a story only a centenarian can tell. And not just any 100-year-old, but a brilliant and unique 100-year-old who lost his father at age 10, graduated from high school at 15, and even now can turn a wood bowl on a lathe with the best of them.
Jack Schwartz is our guest. He spent nearly 4 years as a prisoner of war in Japan during World War II. When we left off, Jack shared that he might have frozen to death in the mountainous terrain of the Rokuroshi prison camp if he'd had to endure the winter there at the end of 1945. Thankfully, the war ended just in time. But just because the Japanese surrendered didn't mean you were a free man.
Well, actually, the war was over August the 14th. But we were up to the camp, and the Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, here again, hostilities have ceased. And he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there? No guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks. And it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks, before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us, and 2 hours later, a parachute was dropping out of the camp full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much, but why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses, and this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
Kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of them anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads. And we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy. And they put the Navy people on board the U.S. Iowa, which was there. And just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags. And they gave us uniforms. They wore cappy uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the plane to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. What you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. And what a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us, because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody.
I bet.
And we stayed there for about a week and sort of got used to living again. We got all uniforms. They gave us each $100, as I recall it. And finally, we all got orders and shipped home. But we went home on a naval vessel. Here again, they didn't have room, but they built shells. We were sleeping three deep on shells, but this didn't matter because we were eating like pigs. And it took us 17 days to get home, and we stopped in Hawaii. Here's another funny one. The captain of the ship wouldn't let us off. He said, I will not be responsible for prisoners of war that I'm taking back to San Francisco. One of the guys on the ship was a Navy ensign, a flyer, and his father, he knew, was an admiral there on Honolulu. He called him, and an hour later, we were off the ship. But then we got to San Francisco.
And the captain wasn't trying to be malicious. He just didn't want to be responsible for one of you not making a home, right?
Well, that's exactly. I'm sure he thought he had to do it. I'm sure he wasn't being mean to us, but it was, really. And it keeps getting funny, ha-ha. We got to San Francisco and land at Fort Mason and get off the ship. Oh, incidentally, while I was on Guam, I called my wife. I called her from Honolulu, so she was up here to meet me. What's between us and the families? A six-foot-high wooden fence. So here we are back in San Francisco. We're still prisoners. And we called each other over the fence. She told me where she was at a hotel. And then they took all of us to Oakville Naval Hospital. And we checked in there. I stayed there an hour, walked out, and thumbed a ride back to San Francisco and took a train home. Took a train home when I was home. Of course, everybody was happy to see me. But I knew I had to do something, so I went down to the Long Beach Naval Hospital, checked in there. I was reported as being AWOL, which nobody bothered about. So that was the end of my captivity.
What was it like for you, aside from talking to her over that wooden fence, when you actually got to look in your wife's eyes again and see her? Because I imagine there had to be a lot of those 1,367 days that you thought about that moment and envisioned that happening someday.
Well, we did, but I can't recall actually what we thought. Actually, I was happy I was, obviously, but I can't recall any details. We did take the train to L.A., and I was still out of uniform. I mean, practically, partly uniform. I was wearing a sweater. We had notes in our pockets to the shore patrol not to pick us up in case they did. That was about it. I stayed in Los Angeles on leave. They gave us accumulated leave and 60 days sick leave. So it wasn't until April of 46 that I actually got back on the duty. In the meantime, I was still Lieutenant J.G. And it turned out during the war, it was practically automatic promotions as the war went on. But they couldn't promote you unless you were there to sign the papers. So he didn't sign them. So about every 6 weeks, I got promoted first lieutenant, lieutenant commander, then the commander. So that's why I ended up at. But
how long did you stay in the Navy?
I stayed in until 1962. I had some fantastic duties.
And I can tell you enjoyed all the duty you had, but I'm sure there's some people saying, hey, if I went in the military, ended up spending 4 years of my life as a prisoner with nothing to eat and nothing to wear and not that many people to talk to, the first thing I'd want to do is get out of the military. But you stayed in for another 17 years after World War II. What was it that you think made you do that and made you love your country and love the Navy as much as you did?
Well, as I say, when I first joined up and got my commission, I knew then a war was going to start. It would be stupid not to know it in 1940. That's why I got in. After I got out, I said, gee, I've seen the worst. Let's see what it's like. See what's good. I'd seen the bad. Yeah. And I did stay in. And as I say, I had wonderful duties, so I'm glad I did stay in. They sent me down to Key West, Florida. That was paradise. And I met my future wife down there and got married. My son was born down there. My stepdaughter, who lives here, was my wife's first child. Of course, she's still mine. I would say that duty in Key West was probably the happiest time of my life, really. Everything was wonderful there.
And then in 1962, you moved here to Hanford, and you've served as this city's director of public works. You've been the city engineer. You're still serving on the grand jury. You must like it here in Hanford a little bit.
Well, let's back up. I want to tell you about the rest of my career.
Oh, go ahead.
From Key West, I got another great duty. They sent me to just outside of Paris. I was on the staff of the, it was called EUCOM, the European Command, the headquarters of all the Americans in Europe. It was called Camp Deloge. It wasn't in Paris. It was about 20 miles outside. Boy, what a break being in there for a little over 3 years. I really enjoyed that duty, too. We traveled a lot, saw all we could of Europe, at least on the western part of it. I did not make captain, so I was due to retire at 20 years, but by some quirk, I was extended for 26 years. I didn't want to retire before I left Europe because that was such good duty. So they sent me back to another good duty, which is at Flagstaff, Arizona. Down there, they were in charge of the nuclear testing up at Mercury, Nevada. And I got put in charge of a project up there. It was the first project where a nuclear weapon was discharged under granite. They were doing some testing to see what they were doing before they built the headquarters there in the Rockies. And that was one of the tests to see what how things reacted in granite. After that was done, I retired and came to Hanford.
On that project, I'm curious, and I'm sure a lot of people are, what was it that you had to do, and was there some responsibility there for you that people's safety was going to depend on the work that you did to design how this was going to work?
Actually, I had nothing to design. It was designed many years before. But there was a tunnel we went down 900 feet and then spread out a few hundred feet and made sort of circular tunnels and put different kinds of lining materials in, wood, steel, soft things like styrofoam, all kinds of different linings, And when they set this nuclear device off, we went back and saw which ones were affected and how they were affected. That was the reason for the project.
So I'm sure I'm not the only one hearing you say that and saying, so they set off a nuclear device in there, and then you went back in, and people are saying, well, what about the radioactivity? So were you in these super spaceman plastic protective suits to keep the radiation out?
Absolutely not. The radiation didn't go that far. The force did, but not the radiation. In fact, they compared the radiation effect there to what's on your wristwatch. So it was really zero, as close to zero as they could get. So it was perfectly safe. While I was there, I knew I was going to retire. It took 6 months to retire, and I was looking for a job, and I was already a registered civil engineer in California. I did that while I was still working in California before the war. I saw this job in Hanford, applied for it, got it, and was very happy with it, so I stayed here. It's sort of funny, I've been here over 50 years, and in my first 49 years, I traveled so much, it was such a difference. Hanford's a great place.
Hanford is a great place, and I know Hanford is happy to have you and is proud of you and should be. Couple more questions, and feel free to add anything that comes to your mind. And I have to ask this question of every veteran I interview, and especially the POWs, like your story, which is an amazing story. And I haven't gotten the sense that you're an overly sentimental guy or a really extremely emotional guy or anything like that. But I still have to ask the question. When you think about everything that you went through, everything that you survived, knowing how many others died in captivity, 30% of all prisoners held by the Japanese died. And then you think about the career that you just told us how much you enjoyed in the Navy and the fact that you got to be a father and a grandfather and do all the things you've done, that none of that would have happened had you died in captivity. How do you account for that? Do you feel like somebody was looking out for you? Is it just the way it happened? How do you think about that reality that you survived all of that and have had the life that you're still enjoying it?
I just think I was lucky, that's all. I'm not an agnostic. I'm sure there's a God, but I don't believe there's a personal God. If there is one, he took care of me, I guess.
Well, I'm thankful that he did, and it's really amazing to ponder everything that you've been through and the impact that you're still having. And I imagine, Jack, that you get a lot of people who see you around Hanford and have no idea that you're pushing the century mark. You don't look your age. And so I imagine this would not be the first time you've been asked this. But what's your secret? How do you stay so young and so active?
Well, I laugh. I told you clean living and hard work. But actually, I do eat properly. I don't smoke. I practically don't drink. A six-pack will last me all summer. I'm not against drinking. I just don't do it. So that's probably helpful. I do eat a lot of vegetables. But maybe that helps. I don't know.
How often do you eat Superior Dairy ice cream? I mean, in Hanford, that's the big question.
Not very often, but only a few months ago, after leaving a city council meeting, because the grand jury goes to the city council meetings, a friend of mine who was also on the jury went across to Superior, and we had one of the really big ones. And I put that down as being the last thing on my bucket list.
As we wrap up, I want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us our story, because it's important for us to know what people like you went through. What is it that you want people to know about World War II, why you did what you did, and what lessons we can learn from people like you?
Well, actually, we were forced into World War II, and we've been in a number of wars since, which I think are terrible. And I looked up the number of four-star officers. During World War II, at the very end, there were 8 four-star officers in all the services together. There's 38 now. And there's what? Instead of 16 million people, there's about 1 million. Doesn't that sound sort of peculiar?
I guess the only other question I would have for you is, what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
I'm proud of the way I did my work in Hanford. I think it did a lot of good because it was pretty disorganized when I got here. And I organized it quite well, I think, and lived it in good shape. So I'm proud of that.
As well he should be. And Hanford's proud of him. America's proud of him. 100-year-old Jack Schwartz. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com. And as we honor all of those who have had to live without freedom for our sake and all of those who remain missing in action, let us never forget that freedom is not free.